The following is a Sunday feast lecture on the Bhagavad Gita, 6th chapter, text number 26, given by Srila Arinda Srivdas on April 26, 1992, in Potomac.
From wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self. Now I'll read Srila Prabhupada's purport. The nature of the mind is flickering and unsteady. But a self-realized yogi has to control the mind. The mind should not control him. One who controls the mind, and therefore the senses as well, is called Gosvami. Or Swami. And one who is controlled by the mind is called Godasa, or servant of the senses. A Goswami knows the standard of sense happiness. In transcendental sense happiness, the senses are engaged in the service of Hrishikesha, or the supreme owner of the senses, Krishna. Serving Krishna with purified senses is called Krishna consciousness. And that is the way of bringing the senses under full control. What is more, that is the highest perfection of yoga practice. So here, this chapter, Dhyan Yoga, is about the Ashtanga Yoga system. At least that's what Krishna is describing. On the surface, there are different systems of yoga, and this is what in America, if you say yoga, that's what people think you mean by yoga, this Ashtanga. Ashtanga, that yoga that has eight branches, beginning yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, and so on. And people, you turn on the television Sunday morning, you'll see some lady there and gym pants or something doing like this. People practice for their health, right, this yoga. But here we see from this verse the actual purpose of yoga. The actual purpose of yoga is to concentrate the mind on the Supreme without any change. Like a candle, Krishna says in this chapter, like a candle in a windless place. Steady concentration of the mind on the Supreme without any flickering or withdrawal. This is called one-pointedness of mind. Samadhi, which is the final and highest goal of yoga practice. In which the yogi experiences unending transcendental bliss. Well, everybody is looking for unending transcendental bliss. It is actually not available by purchase of automobiles, gathering of credit cards, trips to vacation resources, and all these other sorts of things. This is how it is available. So here's this practice of concentration of the mind, pratyahara, withdrawing the mind from the senses, concentration, dhyana, meditation on the Supreme. From wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self. So first let's look at this practice. Here's the yoga practice that you see people are engaged in, this Ashtanga Yoga. They're not really, for the most part, in this country, serious about this practice. They practice for health reasons, but not for actual spiritual enlightenment. And it's a fact that the earliest stages of this yoga practice, if you do it correctly, will give you perfect health. And that's all people are any more interested in, practically. But there's a reason for this. People are taking up yoga, but actually the first thing they're doing is skipping the first two steps. First step is called yama. Second step is called niyama. Yama means rules and regulations. Niyama means more rules and regulations. And then asana, sitting postures. So people go straight to Padmasana or different things to practice the sitting postures of yoga, and they skip the rules and regulations. Krishna, in this chapter, when he begins explaining this yoga process to Arjuna, you have already read, he says, first of all, go to a sacred place. Go to the forest. In the cities, it's not very good for practicing yoga. There's too much disturbance in the atmosphere all the time. Even now, that undisturbed forest, somebody's cutting the logs down, jetted airplanes are going overhead. It's hard to find this. Not a sacred place. There are not so many of those in this country anyway. But that's where you're supposed to go. And he says, preliminary requirement. One has to be free from fear. A yogi is going to sit like this in the middle of the jungle. Tigers are coming by. Snakes are there. He's sitting like this, going to meditate. So what does he do when the tiger comes? Here he is, tiger food, sitting here. If he's frightened, what happens to his meditation? It's all over. So preliminary requirement, without fear. You're already starting on a very high level. Fixed in a vow of brahmachari, Krishna says. Already celibate. Married couples need not apply. Completely fixed in a vow of celibacy. This is just beginning. So in America, the people who are coming teaching yoga, they're forgetting these first steps, because if they insist on these things, they'll not have so many customers. So they go straight to this asana and the sitting posture. Now the sitting postures are there because by practicing them gradually, by that and then by pranayama, by controlling the breath of air, that gradually the yogi is able to gain a very great amount of control over the processes of his own body. Actually, he wants to go into trance and meditate. One thing is, this is like being an athlete. If you get sick, it'll be a disturbance. You can't get a cold. You're going to regulate your breathing. If you get a cold or something, it'll mess things up. By this practice, actually, it so works that the health becomes very, very, very good. And one gradually gains control. It's well documented that yogis who do this, they can slow down their heartbeat and all these other things at will by this. What is the purpose of that? So gradually you can shut down the action of your senses. Withdraw the senses from the sense objects. Slow down the metabolism of your body. You don't have to eat. A little bit every 6 months maybe, so a little rice. They even say that the yogis who are very adept, they simply live on air. So they don't need to be bothered with all this stuff. They're going to concentrate, withdraw on themselves and concentrate the mind. So this is a very heroic process. You have to be like a virtuoso, like a Olympic athlete to do this all the way. Withdrawing the mind, the senses from the sense object, so that you're not disturbed. And then the mind, here now it's talking, you're going to concentrate the mind on the super soul and the heart. The yogi is instructed actually to meditate on Krishna. This is Pantanjali Yoga Sutra, that Lord Vishnu is in the heart, and this is on which the yogi is to meditate without deviation of mind. So here it says, the mind, previous verse, The mind should be fixed, and one should think of nothing else. Then it says here, from wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, we have to bring it back, withdraw it, and bring it back under the control of the self. This is concentration of the mind. Yoga means to concentrate the mind by controlling the senses. This is the goal of yoga practice. So this will happen, that when the mind starts to think of so many things, it is the repository of all ideas of sense gratification. And it's said, of course, that the mind is ruled by the moon. And the moon is always changing, going small and large and strange. So the same way the mind is very flickering and unsteady. Thinks of this, thinks of that, remembers that, ideas, memories, thoughts come bubbling up from nowhere. And left to itself, the mind wanders all over the place. It's like listening to little children talk. Oh, here, there, everywhere, you know. There's a higher facility than mind, which is manas, it's called buddhi, intelligence. By intelligence, we concentrate the mind in one place. And to accomplish anything in this world, we have to exercise some mental control. To sit down and do a problem in arithmetic, we have to concentrate the mind for some time. Say we have some theorem in geometry we are solving. The mind will want to think about this and think about this and wander off this way and wander off that way. But if we want to get through, we have to concentrate. We concentrate on one thing, and this is control of the mind, just to do a little problem in geometry. So this facility to control the mind is called buddhi, or intelligence. So the mind left to itself goes all over the place, just like children babbling about so many things. But when one has become intelligent, then the mind can become fixed and steady. So you will see that this is the practice also of yoga, to concentrate the mind on the Supreme. For how long? Perpetually. The actual goal of this yoga practice is to enter into samadhi and never come out. That is the highest goal. By getting rid, shutting down the senses, shutting down the external senses, shutting out the outside world, concentrating within, shutting down the mind, having the intelligence fixed, and then gradually, by that intense concentration on the Supreme, becoming absorbed in that meditation and experiencing always, through that purification, transcendental bliss. So our Krishna consciousness is also for seriously practicing yoga. We are to go all the way to the end. We also want samadhi, thinking of Krishna 24 hours a day. Not just part-time, but all the time. Just like these yogis. They leave the cities, they go to the Himalayas, they're up in the hills there even now. Not here in the West, but they're up there. They've been up there for 100, 200, 300 years, one man, concentrating the mind. That's their process. That's serious yogis. Once in a while they come down, but this is their process. We are also just as serious, but our practice is bhakti. Yoga. The process, the principle is the same. Concentrate the mind by controlling the senses. But here Prabhupada is talking about the process of bhakti. Is in bhakti we do not try to shut the senses down or negate or deny them. Instead, we focus all the senses on Krishna. And here he alludes to this definition of bhakti given in the Narada Pancharatra. Rishikesha, Rishikena, Sevanam, Bhakti or Uchate. Bhakti means to engage the senses in the service of the master of the senses. This is an easier process because it is more natural. We have to control the senses. Here he's using this word, Goswami. Swami, one who's called spiritually advanced is called Goswami or Swami. Master of what? Of the senses. And the opposite is Godas. Servant of the senses. Servant of the mind. Not in control. People are thinking, I want to be free to enjoy my senses any way I like. They think that's freedom. Well, it's the worst bondage. They're slaves. I want to be free, they say, to smoke a cigarette anytime I feel like it. And there they are, 2 o'clock in the morning. They're out of cigarettes and they have to go in the trash can looking for long butts to satisfy the desire. That's not freedom, that's bondage. And all the senses with their demands is slavery. It is bondage. But one who is Goswami, who is Swami, he's master of the senses, he's not controlled like this. So one has to become free from the dictation of material desire in order to achieve spiritual life. It's not easy to do. And just by withdrawal, it is very, very difficult. If the senses have no engagement, and we just try to withdraw them by force of concentration, we'll find that, especially in these days, it's very difficult. And the mind is so restless and so flickering. And you'll notice that people, as the years go by, at least in my lifetime, the minds are becoming more flickering. You see, certain things make the mind more flickering. For example, television. Because one generation of children is raised watching television, all the teachers in school notice they cannot concentrate as much as they used to be able to. To read a book, you at least have to concentrate more than you have to concentrate to watch television. Actually, not conducive to... it used to be in Indian system for learning Sanskrit, you start with a 5-year-old child and they would memorize all the rules of Panini's grammar. Huge, there's 4,000, 5,000 rules. And the children would sit and chant them all in their head, memorizing. No, they can't. They can't memorize anything practically. It's gone. Just that concentration of the mind is disappearing. So this makes this very difficult, how to attain this strength. So here the process of bhakti yoga is to utilize the senses, all the senses. Control of the senses begins with the tongue. Prabhupada said, you will be surprised to learn that God is first of all realized by means of the tongue. The two propensities are there for vibrating or making sound and tasting. One yoga practice, mauna, is the vow of silence. Not to speak. So they will take a vow of silence. They don't want to say anything material. So they'll not speak. And sit silent like that. And there, everywhere, people sometimes take this vow. And Christians also, and monks, and nuns, they'll take this vow of silence. So that's one way of trying to avoid material activity. The other way is to always speak and chant about Krishna. And to always chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Srila Prabhupada said, the chanting of Hare Krishna is silence. There's no material sound. So if I sit and I chant the Hare Krishna mantra, I'm going, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. My tongue is engaged. My ears are engaged. And there's no material sound. There's no material sound. So this is easier than if we all sit here silent and the mind is thinking so many thoughts and so on. The same thing if you want to control the tongue. Because in the matter of eating, like these yogis, you can go on a permanent diet, become very skinny, fast for long, long periods of time. That's also very difficult. In America, we see that every year thousands of people are fasting to lose weight, and they go shrink, swell up, shrink, swell up, shrink. This is called, this is called alternating bhoga tyaga. Enjoying, renouncing, enjoying, renouncing. This is also unsteady. So we want to control our eating habits. You can try to stop eating, but the tongue wants to taste. Again, if we eat that tasty things that have been offered to Krishna, then the tongue is controlled. There's no karma in that eating. It's just as though you were fasting completely. Better than fasting completely, because actually the taste of prasadam will bring you spiritual ecstasy higher than liberation. Actually, think of the whole thing. Just take a simple thing. A devotee, how does he think of Krishna 24 hours a day? We're here in this world, we're so busy, we have so many things to do. You take a simple material activity like cooking and eating. Eating is one of the most basic, primitive, fundamental drives of material nature. Hardest thing to get under control. So, our process of Krishna consciousness is to take the ordinary activities of life and transform them into spiritual activities. So if I cook for Krishna, my kitchen is very clean. I only make those things that Krishna will like. I do it in devotion. It's not that I'm cooking for me and going to offer it to Krishna first. I'm cooking for Krishna and will take what's left. Every time I should be thinking of Krishna. When I go shopping for the vegetables, I'm thinking of Krishna, who's going to eat these vegetables. I'm in the supermarket. This is a place for the senses to go crazy, but my senses are under control. Krishna will like this eggplant. Krishna will like this green peppers. Krishna will like these tomatoes. I'm not thinking of my sense gratification. I'm thinking of Krishna. Then I take them home. Everybody around me, I may look just like anybody else. They can't tell the difference seeing. But if the devatas had a computer printout that showed the karma of everybody in that supermarket, where the devotee is, there's nothing on the chart. There's no karma. Everybody else is making karma. They're buying meat. They're buying so many things. The karma is being produced. But where the devotee is, it's just like he's not there. There's no material existence, because everything is engaged for Krishna's service. It goes home, cuts it up, prepares it. The senses are being used. So many things are there. Thinking of Krishna. It's like if you love somebody. If a woman loves a man and she's preparing a dinner for him, she's thinking of him. In the same way we think of Krishna. We don't taste it. Krishna has to be the first to enjoy. Devotees that learn how to put in salt and turmeric and everything without tasting. So again, there's no material activity. Then we have a plate for Krishna. We put it on that plate. We arrange it nicely. Water, maybe a little flour, some tulsi leaves, because Krishna likes it with tulsi leaves. And we take it, we offer to Krishna. Here we have a big elaborate altar. Priests are trained, they chant Sanskrit mantras and so on. At home, you may have just a very simple little table, picture of Krishna. You don't know any Sanskrit, that's all, just bow down, Krishna, please accept this meal I made for you. I hope you enjoy it. And chant Hare Krishna. Either way, it's the devotion he wants, not that we know all the rituals. If you can learn them, that's nice, but... So then, you take off the plate. This is the Krishna's remnants, his leftovers. Just like sometimes servants in a house, they'll eat the leftovers from the meal or the master. So we take Krishna's leftovers, we give them to others, we take it. And then it has this wonderful taste, not a material taste. Because now Krishna has enjoyed it. It's karmaless food, and by making, eating, tasting and relishing that prasadam, I remember Krishna and I make spiritual advancement. So here you take this basic activity, material activity, and by bhakti yoga, by putting Krishna in the center, the whole thing is meditation. All varied activities are there, even driving in my car to the supermarket, earning the money that's going to pay for the food. That's also meditation on Krishna. So in this way, by Krishna consciousness, I can think of Krishna 24 hours a day. There's no activity with which I'm not thinking of Krishna. If I'm doing something, if I forget Krishna, if I'm not thinking of Krishna, then I have to immediately bring my mind back, as it says here. So there are many ways to cultivate remembering Krishna. Last night, actually, we spoke on this topic concerning chanting the holy name. That's another. When we chant the Hare Krishna mantra on beads, when you chant like this, we go and we chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The mind will wander. And we bring it back. We bring it back. There's a good way to practice that very intensely. When the mind wanders, bring it back. We actually, we all love Krishna very, very deeply. But that love for Krishna is now covered. And by practice, we're going to reawaken that love by this sadhana. It's called practice. We're practicing by rules and regulations Krishna consciousness. And you think, well, how can rules and regulations bring love? But it does. Because it helps us to reawaken the love that's already there. When I was 16 years old, there was a girl that I was in love with named Celia. And I didn't have any trouble concentrating on her practically 24 hours a day. I did not have to force my mind to think of her. You know, quite the opposite. I couldn't think about anything else. You know? Like with all these things, it was a temporary situation. But that was, when there's love, there's attraction. Like that. You meditate on Krishna and the love is for Krishna. And that, you know, Cecilia changed. She got another boyfriend. I forgot what happened exactly. But, you know, after a while, there was somebody else. And this happens in the material world. Whatever we love changes. But when we love Krishna, that's natural and real. And actually, when we love Cecilia or we love John, actually it's Krishna we love. And maybe that person we think we are loving, they have a little of Krishna's beauty, a little of Krishna's strength, a little of Krishna's attractiveness. They, whatever you see in this world is just a little bit of Krishna's splendor. What we really want is Krishna. So that love is when that love is naturally there, then there's attention to Krishna. But by practice, we can reawaken that love. Because love begins with interest, and interest begins with attention. So it's natural. So even if we use our intelligence to force our mind to think of Krishna, by thinking of Krishna constantly, that love will start to reawaken. So right now, because of our contamination, the mind wanders all over the place. So we bring it back, we bring it back, we chant our japa, we bring it back. It's a little spiritual discipline. But after a while, just by giving Krishna the respect of that attention, we begin to experience Krishna himself. Because when we meditate upon Krishna, Krishna is there directly in that meditation. When we think of his form, Krishna is actually there. When we hear his name, Krishna is actually there. When we look at him, read his book, Krishna is actually there. Prabhupada talks about this. Talks about how we should hear Srimad Bhagavatam, for example. He says that when Maharaj Parikshit heard Srimad Bhagavatam, he drank Srimad Bhagavatam with his ears. He drank the nectar of Srimad Bhagavatam with his ears. He was so eager to hear. So Prabhupada says one has to hear Srimad Bhagavatam with rapt attention, with total concentration of the mind. He says no one can hear with rapt attention unless the mind is pure. And we cannot be pure in mind unless we're pure in eating, pure in sleeping, pure in mating, pure in defending. These are basic things. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. The animals do it, everybody does. But there's a way to do these things so that they're pure. If all our activities of life, even the most basic, are pure, then the mind becomes pure. Then we can hear Srimad Bhagavatam with rapt attention. And what happens when we hear Srimad Bhagavatam with rapt attention? Krishna appears directly. There's no difference between Krishna and Krishna's description. He's there. So Prabhupada says Krishna is directly present to the hearer of Srimad Bhagavatam. You see Krishna face to face, Prabhupada says, as you're seeing me, I'm seeing you. Krishna is there. So many ways Krishna is coming to us, even though we're impure. That's his kindness. He's available to our senses all the time, if we want to take advantage of that. I'll give you one last example. I have a friend, actually Prahlad Nandaswami in this movement, and I was staying with him for 1 month a couple of years ago in Vrindavan, and we were both teaching at this Vrindavan Institute of Higher Education. I was teaching a course on defeating Mayavad philosophy, and he was teaching a course called Memorizing Krishna Book. That's what it was called. So I've known Prahlad Nanda Maharaj for a long time, but this is the first time I ever got to spend a lot of time with him. So I started to talk to him about this Memorizing Krishna Book, because that was kind of the thing that, I don't know, I read the pastimes and everything, but the idea, I went to his class and he sat there and like page by page he would teach the students how to read the pastime and try to remember even all the little details. So I discovered what he does. He said he'd read these pastimes and memorize them. Just take one of Krishna's lila in that Krishna book, Prabhupada, easy enough to do, and study it. Read it and then try to remember the paragraph. And he had a system for trying to remember the whole thing. And then gradually, in your own mind, just go through this pastime of Krishna, remembering all the details and everything. So he said that after a while, he said you keep doing it. He said the pastimes just go by themselves. And then as that happens, they become more and more real. So then I realized that this was what he was doing. I'd see Prahladananda Swami, walking through the streets or doing something else, but going in his head, automatically, this pastime of Krishna. And that way, gradually, one lives in Goloka Vrindavan. It may be anywhere, but that pastimes are going on. One becomes absorbed more and more intense in the pastimes of Krishna. That's another way. So there's so many avenues available for us to follow this injunction, basic principle of Krishna consciousness. Positive rule, always remember Krishna. Negative, never forget him. So we learn how to do this in every aspect of life, and that we'll achieve the perfection of yoga, even though we're living in around Washington, D.C., and there's cars and airplanes and so many harassments of modern civilization, even though we live in a family, even though we have spouses and children and money worries. All of that will not interfere with our constant meditation on Krishna. We will achieve the same kind of constant meditation that a yogi sitting high in some hills in the remote reaches of the Himalayas by shutting out the whole world. He'll attain that. We'll do better right here in the middle of this place by following these principles given to us by Srila Prabhupada. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. I should ask any questions, comments? Yeah.
How should one focus the mind and set what type of meditation? They're really not happy with their japa. As myself, I'm not doing it for more than 16 months now. I really want to improve my japa, find agitation. The mind a real problem. What exactly should I be meditating? The worry.
Oh, well. When somebody asked Prabhupada, when we chant our japa, what should we think about? And Prabhupada said, chanting Hare Krishna is thinking. So, to chant your japa, what you meditate on is the Hare Krishna mantra. That is Krishna. It is good that one be regulated if there's trouble concentrating the mind. That's why here in the Krishna temple we have facility, 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. there's a place. Tulsi Devi is there also. This is very good practice. Prabhupada says in his commentary on Chaitanya Charitamrita that it's very powerful to chant Hare Krishna with a vow in front of Tulsi Devi. That's why when we chant in the temple, all Tulsi Devi is there. So at home also people can keep Tulsi. And so it's always very good to have a special place, a special time. So if you're already, like for example, say you want to chant japa. When I first started chanting Hare Krishna, I didn't live in a temple. But when I wanted to chant japa, I had like a special seat I put down. So I put down a seed, I lit some incense, so you know my mind was in the frame. So by regulation, sometimes that helps. If Tulsi Devi is there, that helps. And then you just have to struggle with your mind. You'll want to chant Hare Krishna. It's a big job just to get to one round without your mind wandering. I know this very well. You'll go chant Hare Krishna 3 or 4 times and suddenly an idea will come, or you'll think of some. And people, sometimes their minds wander. Once I brought my professor of mine at school when I was still a student to the temple, and we had kirtan, you know, and he was chanting in kirtan and clapping and everything. I said afterwards, I said, how did you like the kirtan? He said, oh great. I said, I got so many good ideas. So I could see that the chanting just kind of lulled him and his mind was going on. So that can happen. So then it's just a battle with the mind. It's good to chant sometimes with other devotees around and to chant at a regulated time. What I used to do when I found I had difficulty, like you're talking about, was I just forced myself when I was living in a temple. I would go in the temple room at 4:30 for Mangal Arati, and I would not leave until 8:30 after class. I would just not allow myself to leave. And I just forced myself to stay there. And in that way, gradually, by this discipline, then I became a temple president, so I used to try to make everybody stay there. And some people really went crazy trying to get out. I gotta get out. So I know it's hard. But this is some discipline. You know, it may seem hard, but if you look at what these yogis do up in the Himalayas, it's so easy compared to what they have to go through. They have to sit up there, it's so cold, it's hot, that, you know, it's terrible. I've seen them, you know, in India, sitting in the blazing sun with fires all around and everything. We don't do anything as hard as that. So that's what's required. You just have to use a little force. And if you don't have the willpower, then you get somebody to say, please, you force me. And that will help. That's my advice. Anybody else? Any questions or comments?
You alluded a little bit to difficulty in practicing Hatha Yoga in city life. But on the other hand, Bhakti Yoga is pretty easy to practice in city life. Just an observation about city life. The children are supposed to be pious and innocent and all that. But even the children are very agitated these days. In city life, they have seen nothing, just drugs, take people, taking drug and killings next door. So it's pretty tough out there. And I think the Bhakti Yoga is a good medicine.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And also, if there's enough Bhakti Yoga, we'll be able to change that a little bit. Because actually, an agricultural economy, agrarian economy, most people living in the country, is better for everybody's spiritual life. Human beings are meant to live in villages. Actually, you know, when you go to a city, it's so big, so then they make villages anyway, you know, Greenwich Village and this village, you're in the middle of New York City and Greenwich Village, they call it, you know. So people actually, they all want to live in villages anyway. It's natural. So we would like to change that eventually, that the cities are not good for spiritual life. No one goes to city for enlightenment, they always leave for enlightenment. But still, if the city is there, this is the best, you're right. Anything else?
Yeah. You remember talking about yogis living 100 to 200 years. So it seems that because they can perform these supernatural things.
It's not supernatural, by the way. It's natural, just that people don't know about it anymore. But.
Okay, well, it seems like because they can do these feats, the mystic yoga process would be higher than the bhakti yoga.
Higher?
More advanced.
Well, a devotee is even more advanced. He just lives as long as Krishna wants him to live. So he's not also interested. I mean, our idea is not living a long time. Bhagavatam says, better 1 minute of full consciousness than a long life lived like a tree. So that's our goal. So it's a fact that these yogis live a long time. You see them at that Kumbh Mela, you know, they come out. And they say they're very old, like 200, 300, 400 years old. I don't know if anyone's checked up on it scientifically. I don't know if you can tell how old people are, growth rings or something. But that's the claim, that they're very, very old. Prabhupada says they're that old, so I believe them. But that's not our goal. Our goal is their quality of life. And a devotee lives as long as Krishna wants him to live. And when he leaves his body, he goes to Goloka Vrindavan. So that's not a problem either. That's the solution. Okay, we better stop now. Thank you very much. Glory to you.